Hey everyone, this is Joe Heiler from SportsRehabExpert.com, and today I've got Kevin Neild on the phone. Kevin's been on here a bunch of times now, and so most of you know who he is, but for those of you that don't, he is the Director of Athletic Development for Endeavor Sports Performance. He's been doing that quite a while, really specializing in hockey, and he's got a lot of great, he's done some webinars, some interviews on this site talking about hockey, hip and groin injuries, and he's just released a new DVD project. It's called Optimizing Movement. And it's a two DVD set. It's I just checked it out last week. It's really cool, and I wanted to get Kevin on here to talk about it today. So, Kevin, welcome to the call.
Well, thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity to be on. This is always fun for me to have an opportunity to catch up with you guys. So,
well, good. Yeah, it's always good having you on here. And you know, like I said, I really enjoyed the DVD, and I wanted to, I mean, a lot of cool topics, and I want to get into some of that stuff and how you assess your athletes and then how you guys correct some of their movement imbalances and all. So why don't we start out, tell us a bit more about yourself and what you've been up to lately, and then, you know, go ahead and go right into giving us a bit of an overview of the DVD and, you know, who it's for and what types of material you cover.
Yeah, I think since the last time we spoke, I've been on a little bit of a continuing education binge here. I started and finished a massage program, so I'm an LMT now, which has been fun. It's kind of added a new dynamic to what we're able to do with our athletes at our facility. Went through the three main ART courses, so I'm full body certified with that. I had an opportunity last year to take one of Andrew Espina's functional range release courses, which was really good. Went through several PRI courses and went through their PRT credentialing process. And then just earlier this year, we were able to host a level one and level two rock tape, or, you know, I don't know if they would like this, but a kinesio taping course at our facility. So I think all of that is just kind of in an effort to be able to add some different things to our services with our athletes, and then just make sure that if people need some level of care and, you know, they're potentially not willing to drive another 30 minutes to go see the person that I think they should see, that we can start to troubleshoot some of that stuff in-house. But, you know, as you mentioned, I've been at Endeavor now for almost 5 years. We just wrapped up our fifth summer there, and it was an interesting summer. I think we had a lot more kind of junior NCAA hockey players than we have in the past, and assessed everybody at the beginning of the summer, and then did a lot of work in individualizing programs, not just from a corrective standpoint, but from an actual, you know, what is the intent from a training adaptation standpoint for this program. Did a lot more work to individualize that stuff based on the guys, and when we retested at the end of the summer, we found some pretty interesting things. So that's been keeping me busy over the last several months here. And like we talked about briefly before, I think September is always a little bit quieter for us, which is welcome at this time of year.
Well, and then go ahead and tell us a bit more about the DVD. And, you know, I know, I guess what I know it's from a lecture you did, and I wasn't sure exactly where that was, but maybe tell us a bit about it, and then who it's for, and what the, you know, what materials you're going to cover.
Sure. The DVDs are from a one-day seminar that Joel Jamison and I did at, there's a facility in Nashua, New Hampshire, called Dynamic Strength and Conditioning, that a guy named Kevin Buckley runs, and he asked Joel and I to come in and do a one-day there, and Joel was going to speak about energy systems work, so Kevin kind of asked me to speak about the assessment process, and how we use that information to alter our programs. And I think, too, a big piece is how to use some of this corrective information in a group setting. So from kind of a broader perspective, the presentation, I think, as a whole, just kind of walks through the lens through which I view human movement. So, you know, over the last several years, I've taken a lot of PRI courses. I've studied quite a bit of Greg Cook's work, and I've done the FMS courses and had a couple opportunities to sit in on DNS courses, and all of those things have had a very significant impact on the way that not just that we assess people in some of our corrective approaches, but just the way that we view everything as a whole. And, you know, I think the DVD dives pretty deep into that, and then, you know, the assessment, the actual assessment process that we have taken our athletes through, and I think there's tried to show as many videos of those assessments as we could so we could show people exactly how we're implementing them and what types of things we're looking for when we do that. And then some of the actual data from, it would have been the 2012 off-season hockey group at this point, just to show like what PRI and what some of these other folks are saying is affecting a significant portion of the population is consistent with what we've been finding with our athletes. So kind of based on all that, we dive into how we implement a corrective approach in group settings, which, you know, I think all of that answers or hopefully starts to answer some of the questions that I get fairly frequently about like what assessments we're using and how we're implementing, especially PRI information. Everybody wants to know, like, how are you implementing that in a group setting and in a performance training setting? I think it has the reputation of being a little rehab heavy, and there's a disconnect there for some of the people that are more towards my end of the continuum, I guess. And one of the goals with all of that was really to help remove some of the barriers that people working in training settings have with integrating assessment and corrective exercise into their programs. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have experiences in private settings to help out at some professional level camps and to have intern opportunities in collegiate settings. And I'm aware that I kind of work in like a training fantasy land where I have complete autonomy to do whatever I think is best. And that's not always possible for people in other situations. And there are some legitimate hurdles in terms of how much time people have available and the number of athletes they see and, you know, knowing what to do with assessment results once you get them. And I think for a lot of people that kind of leads to this, like, oh, I can never do that in my setting. And to me, it's like, you know, maybe they can't do exactly what I'm doing, but it doesn't need to be an all or none thing. And I think everybody can and should do something. Even at a minimum, if it's just learning to become a more astute observer of movement, I'd say, and then, you know, learn to make basic program accommodations for individuals that may present with certain postures or structures or movement impairments that are going to better suit the needs of that person.
Well, and I want to talk about some of the specific, you know, or have you cover some of the specific topics a bit. And where I wanted to start out was with, you talked about your four foundations for optimal movement. Why don't you go ahead and give an overview of those foundations, and then I wanted to spend a little bit of time in particular on one of them.
Yeah, I think optimal movement to me kind of comes down to this four-step approach. You want to establish joint neutrality or centration if people have kind of been through some of the DNF stuff. When you have a foundation of that, you want to move on to create individual and goal-specific full mobility. And then the last two things, I think, are kind of the same. Go hand in hand in that we really need to appreciate regional interdependence, and then we need to teach and coach. I think the neutrality and the mobility thing kind of go hand in hand, where you need to ensure that before you look at how much range of motion a joint has, or before you overanalyze that information, you need to make sure that the joint is starting from a centered position. And, you know, the analogy I think that is fairly easy to understand is that if you rotate a pelvis one direction over fixed femurs, one hip is going to go into internal rotation and one hip is going to go into external rotation. And if you're starting, if you goniometer hip IR and ER from that position, you shouldn't have the same amount of external rotation on both sides. You shouldn't have the same amount of internal rotation on both sides. You should probably have the same total arc, but the breakdown shouldn't be the same on both sides because you're not starting from the same position in both hips. And if you look at that, if you do in fact have the same exact internal rotation on both sides, then it's likely that one of those hips has a little bit of capsular or ligamentous laxity. Likewise, if they both have the same ER, it's likely that one of those hip capsules has been compromised. And, you know, all of that to kind of illustrate this point that when there's this appearance of full mobility, when you look at someone and you think, like, okay, they have everything we want, but they aren't in a neutral position, it's often the case that there's something pathological kind of underlying why they still have full mobility from a non-neutral position. And then one of the other big things here, and you know, with all the FAI research that's come out over the last decade, really this has been something that I've really been big on over the last several years, and that's that full range of motion, full mobility should really be discussed within the context of the individual structures and what their goals are. And there was actually a study published this year from Philippon's group out in Colorado that looked at asymptomatic youth hockey players. And I don't know if you or your listeners have come across this yet, but they found that in peewees, which for the non-hockey crowds are hockey players aged 10 to 12 years old, they found that 37% already had femoral acetabular impingement or bony overgrowth of either their femoral neck, the head-neck offsets decrease a little bit, or of the acetabular hood. And with that group, 48% had labral tears. And then by the time that the kids were 16 to 19, which is the midget age group, 93% had FAI and 93% had labral tears. There was another study, which those statistics to me are not surprising, but they are a bit alarming. There's another study that came out this year that looked at NFL prospects playing college football. They found that 90% of the players that they looked at and 87% of the hips had findings consistent with FAI, and that the more bony overgrowth there was, the more likely it was that the individual had symptoms. To me, like all of these things are, this information, I think we're going to see more and more of this in different populations. It's almost becoming hard to ignore, but there's still, especially in the training side of things, there's still this thought like everybody must squat past parallel or it's not a full squat. And there are other examples, but the idea is like if you take somebody that has one of these bony overgrowths that results in a limitation in hip flexion and then you tell them to squat past parallel, they're going to hit end-range hip flexion. Their pelvis is going to rotate backwards over a fixed femur, which essentially is just chewing up the labrum. And then if they keep going, eventually they're going to round through their lumbar spine. You get loaded lumbar flexion with a essentially fixed pelvic position, which is not a hopefully is not something that we're desiring in an exercise setting. So it's just kind of like, you know, a lot of the time that I've been working is with ice hockey players, so I'm very sensitive to some of these structural adaptations. But really, it's about watching people move and understanding that it's not just hockey players. You know, like this study came out of football players. There has been other evidence that said one in four adult males has some sort of bony overgrowth consistent with FAI. And it's just something that I think I try to be aware of consistently, and I think some of the kids that have come to us from other programs that have chewed up hips or sensitive backs that get kind of cranky under load, and a lot of times it's like, oh yeah, like I was always just told to keep going lower to improve my flexibility, and I don't know that you're going to outstretch a bony overgrowth.
Yeah, well, those are some pretty crazy numbers there too. I wasn't aware of those, but I wouldn't doubt it. You know, you brought the football player point all summer long. I work with one of the local high schools, and it's just, I mean, it's heavyweight all the time, deep squats. And I can't tell you how many of these guys come up to me, you know, when we first got started, like, my hip flexors are killing me. Like, they always hurt. You know, I mean, they feel like they've strained their hip flexors, and they just got to stretch them harder. And I think the reality is more of, like, along the lines of what you were saying, is, you know, they're more just grinding up their hip joints and their hip labrums.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, and this is a little bit outside of my scope, but one of the things that I'm aware of is that when people say, like, I've a lot of times the athletes will describe to me, even during, like, a quadruped rock test, they'll say, like, oh, I feel some tightness in my adductor. It's like, well, it's not your adductor that's limiting this range of motion. It's probably some sensation in your hip labrum that you're feeling. And being able to distinguish, you know, what's muscular versus what is more joint-oriented can be difficult, I think, for the kids, but it's an important distinction to make because, you know, I would guess, like you kind of alluded to, that those guys feeling tight in their hip flexors is probably something a little bit more labrum and joint oriented than they may be realizing.
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, we've been aware for so long that, I mean, especially those of us that have done the functional movement screen of the SFMA work, that, you know, a real obvious one would be like hamstring length. And, you know, everybody feels tight in their hamstrings when they try to do a toe touch or an active straight leg raise, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the majority of the time it's not the hamstrings problem. Much of the time it's their inability to flex their lumbar spine. And I think this hip flexor tightness is, you know, kind of the same along those same lines. That's where they feel it, but that's not necessarily what's going on. So they just keep hammering it and hammering it, I think, to their detriment. But one thing you did indicate, and this goes along with that same thing. I mean, there was a quote you, I don't know if it's, this was from PRI or if this was something you had come up with, but when you talked about joint neutrality, you said it's, you know, you defined it as the appearance of full mobility in the absence of neutrality, which is often going to be indicative of pathology. Could you just, I mean, I know you've kind of talked about that, but just, you know, go ahead and tell me kind of where you found that and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think I don't know if that's a PRI phrase, but it's certainly a PRI concept.
Yeah. Well, I love the way you phrased it. So I definitely wanted to bring it up. So.
Well, I appreciate that. I think to me, like, it comes back to the idea that I encountered all of the FMS, and I've learned from some other people that have gone through the SFMA training in that process. I encountered all of that information before I ever heard of PRI. So that's kind of my background in approaching movement and kind of assessing people and seeing what limitations may be. And I think what PRI has added is that, at least in my mind, you need to make sure that they're starting from this neutral position before you can really interpret some of the other assessments that I was doing. And, you know, to one of the kind of connections between the two is that when we do an FMS active straight leg raise, one of the things that we see frequently is that the left side will be a little bit less, they'll have less hip flexion or less of an active straight leg raise on the left side compared to the right. Not always, but very, very frequently. And oftentimes that coincides with what PRI describes as a left AIC pattern, which in this regard, I guess the most relevant piece of that is that the left pelvis is tipped forward into anterior tilt. So
sure,
you can imagine how that might pre-stretch a hamstring and how it may limit range of motion a little bit. And that, if they're in that pattern, you want that left hamstring to have less length. If they have the same, and I understand that the active straight leg raise is not just a hamstring length test, but in this situation, if they have less length on that left, or the appearance of less length because of the position that their pelvis is in, that would be a desirable limitation. Whether it's within a, you know, a 3-3 distinction or a 2-2 distinction, or whether it crosses one of those borderlines and makes it a 3-2 asymmetry, if they're in that position, you would want the one side to express less movement than the other. And if it doesn't, it might be because they've over-lengthened their hamstring, possibly from too much stretching or from attempting to move symmetrically when one half of the body was in a very different starting position from the other. And that, to me, is it comes back to that idea of the appearance of full mobility in the absence of neutrality is often indicative of pathology. Or, you know, maybe they're not hurt, but it's something to be aware of. If you see symmetrical movement and you know they're starting in an asymmetrical position, that gets my thought process, I think, going in a little bit different direction. Whereas, you know, maybe 4 years ago, pre-PRI, I might look at it and think like, okay, good. You know, they're symmetrical. Let's move on.
Yeah. Well, it's such a cool topic. I definitely wanted to bring it up and have you talk about it a bit, but yeah, there's definitely got a ways to go with that too. So it's interesting stuff. But well, let's move on then. And the other thing I wanted to have you talk about a bit, and we started alluding to this, is what kind of assessments do you guys use there? And the way I guess you guys phrased it again, or on the DVD, was what assessments can have the greatest impact. So So could you talk or, you know, give a little bit of overview on that, because you had some different categories there as well.
Yeah, and again, for people that don't work in my situation, the message that I want to send is figure out the biggest bang for your buck assessments that you can implement and that will impact your programming and use those. And if it's three things instead of 10 or 15, then fine. But use the three that are going to get you the most valuable information. And the approach that we take with this isn't much different than the idea of neutrality first and then mobility second. And I think one of the kind of algorithms that I've really bought into from the FMS process is that it should be mobility first, then stability, and then kind of get into some of the integrated movement stuff. And I think what PRI has added to that for me is kind of step zero. It's assess for neutrality, then assess for structure and mobility, then get into stability and integrated movement stuff. And for us, the neutrality assessments all come back to PRI assessments. So people come in, we'll do an adduction drop test, which is essentially a modified Oberst test. We'll do an extension drop, which is essentially a modified Thomas test. We'll do a passive abduction lift test. Moving into some of the postural respiration stuff, we'll look at shoulder flexion. We'll look at horizontal shoulder abduction. And then we'll look at shoulder external and internal rotation as well. From a structure mobility standpoint, the shoulder IRER is we can check that to see if somebody has a pretty significant internal rotation deficit. Is it, you know, are they is it because they have some sort of torsion or aversion through that shoulder joint? So we'll look at total arc range of motion. Hip, we'll look at ER and IR. We'll do a Craig's test to see where they are in terms of antiversion. Then we'll do a quadruped rock test just to get kind of a basic understanding of where they are in terms of hip flexion, range of motion, and just see if any red flags pop out throughout that process. And then, you know, the if you follow that line of thinking, then the next things that we would do is a trunk stability push-up and a rotary stability test from the FMS, and then get into their inline lunge, their hurdle step, and their deep squat. That, to me, is the algorithm that makes the most sense. Make sure they're starting in a neutral position, and if they're not, screen that out and make sure that you can address that first. Get an understanding of where their mobility is and if there are any structural changes that you're going to have to be aware of, like a FAI, hip flexion, range of motion. And then get more into the stability and integrated movement stuff. And for us, those latter two points, I think, you know, if you're careful about watching the way that your athletes or clients warm up and the way that they move and the way that they exercise, you can't quantify stability and integrated movement like you could if you were using a system like the FMS, but you can certainly qualitatively pick up on what somebody may be limited in and make some program, whether it's exercise accommodations or program adjustments as a whole to, again, to suit the needs of that individual.
Well, and then let's spend a little bit of time, too, talking about some of the testing results that you found, because you had some, I mean, again, it was just one of those interesting topics, and when you went through and tested your hockey guys this summer, and just maybe could you talk about some things that really surprised you with your testing, or maybe some other things that, you know, might be surprising to others but don't really surprise you much anymore, you know, knowing what you know now?
Sure. I think one of the things that became apparent last summer, so in 2012, is that a lot of people, the overwhelming majority of the players that we tested, had some sort of shift in the arc of their hip rotation range of motion from one side to the other. So the total arc may have been, you know, within a degree or three when you add internal and external rotation for each side and then compare side to side. But with this, what I described as a shift in range of motion, meaning one side might have 5 degrees more external rotation, and one side might have 5 degrees more internal rotation, but the total arc is the same. I think I said in the DVD that, you know, like, don't worry about which one has more of which for now, because I've seen a little bit of both. And I went back through some of the data, and it really seemed to be, there was certainly some cases where, you know, somebody might have had more ER on the left and another person might have had more ER on the right. So there was kind of an indication that the shifts could go either direction. And I went back through and really tried to tease out, you know, was there one shift that seemed to be more frequent or prevalent than the other? And then this summer, it was really apparent that when people aren't in a neutral starting position, they tend, in a seated hip rotation assessment, they tend to have more external rotation on the left side and more internal rotation on the right side, just out of the gate testing. And I've seen discrepancies as small as, you know, 2 or 3 degrees, which I don't overinterpret, because I think there's clearly a degree of measurement error based on how they're sitting, based on the cushiness of the surface, you know, based on if they're, I tell everybody to sit up tall to try to accommodate for this, but if somebody's leaning a little bit more forward or leaning a little bit more back, they're going to have a little bit more hip flexion clearance. So, you know, 2 or 3 degrees, I don't worry too much about, but we've seen a lot of 5 to 8 degree shifts. I've seen some 10 to 12 degree shifts, and that to me is fairly significant. And it seems to correlate with the guys that when they're in between sets or when they're hanging out talking to somebody, they're always shifted into that right hip and just standing. Essentially, all of their weight is loaded through their right leg. And it's, you know, some of the guys we talk to, and it's like, like, you notice that you do this, and it's like, well, yeah, I do this all the time. Like, okay, like that, at least they're aware of it, and then we can start to have the conversation about maybe shifting over and spending some time in their life on their left foot as well. But the other big thing that I think surprises me a little bit is that, you know, working with so many hockey players, there's always this idea that all of them have tight hip flexors, and I've tested a lot of people over the last several years, and I don't find nearly as many hip extension limitations as I would have thought. And a lot of the ones that we do find, when you take them through some basic corrective work and teach them how to, you know, breathe into a balloon and some of those concepts, a lot of times they clear right away. And then, you know, there's some other cases that certainly we have to take a more hands-on approach with, but that idea of everybody has tight hip flexors and we really need to put a premium on stretching them, it isn't really supported with the testing results that we found. And I think, to me, I don't know that that idea is necessarily inherently wrong, but I come back to the idea of, if somebody's in that, in one of these patterns, and they may kind of be predisposed for anterior hip capsule laxity as it is, I'm certainly more careful about how much hip flexor stretching they're doing, and more importantly, how they're going about doing it. Because you see a lot of people just kind of push their pelvis forward, and it's almost visible that they're kind of forcing their femoral head through that anterior capsule.
Yeah, definitely. I see that one all the time. Well, and one other thing I wanted to have you hit on a bit, and this was, you know, kind of getting more into what you guys then do to control these or to address these things, is one of your other topics you talked about was pervasive movement considerations, which, again, I thought was pretty interesting and deals with a lot of this neutrality and improving motion and mobility.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people hear corrective and they think like corrective exercise only, and to me, a corrective strategy can really be a three-pronged approach, and that's, you can add corrective exercises, you can remove provocative exercises, and then you can teach exercise performance based on an individual structure, or, you know, maybe as a subset of that, you can cue exercise technique based on the patterns or positions or just kind of the movement and position tendencies of that individual in general. And these ideas, the what I think of as pervasive, seem to influence the performance of most exercises. You know, and one of them I think that we've certainly been paying more attention to since going through some of the seminars with DNS and with PRI is the rib positioning and then really rib and pelvic alignment relative to one another. And if, you know, I think some of this can be a little bit hard to visualize without actually seeing it, but if somebody's hyperlordotic through their lumbar spine, frequently they have an anterior pelvic tilt. Frequently they have an anterior rib flare. Sometimes it's one more than the other. A lot of times it's both. And when you load through that, you're more likely to drive them further into lordosis. And we've seen that with squatting patterns. We see that with deadlifting patterns where people go to find stability and they hyperarch through their back to get it. We see it in lower level exercises like glute bridges and slide board hamstring curls and even like a half-kneeling belly press or pow-off press. And to me, like there are a couple other examples of concepts like that kind of apply to multiple exercises. But with that one in general, it's like, okay, so we know that this position is important for all of these different exercises. So how are we going to teach our athletes to address this simply in a way that they can understand, in a way that's going to positively influence the position and then the function of all the musculature around that consistently in these different exercises? And one cue that we've gotten a lot of mileage out of with regards to rib positioning specifically is just to exhale fully to set your ribs and then do everything that you usually would. So, you know, I think we don't want people completely locked down and, you know, without breathing through a lot of these exercises, but if we can get them to exhale fully to feel their ribs come down and then have them gain some control over that expiratory position of their ribs, that's going to put their core in a better position to control stability through that area anyway, and that's true of all of those exercises that I kind of referenced earlier. And you know, a lot of the kids, I think it makes sense to them because they feel some of the symptoms of not being in the right position. You know, when people get up from doing a slide board hamstring curl and they say like, oh, my low back is lit up, or I feel like my low back is cramping or it hurts or whatever words they may use, you get them to breathe out and focus on pulling their hips under to full hip extension, but not driving past that into a lumbar extension. And as they extend their legs out, you allow them to drop their ribs down with that movement, and that pain goes away completely, in my experience, in most cases, unless there's something more significant going on. So that's kind of the idea. And those, there are four ideas that I put in these. That's like intern meeting one with the people that come to our facility. I want you guys to look for these four things in every exercise and constantly think back to almost like that's your movement audit. In any given exercise, how are people doing with these four things? And I think that if you can address those four things, that it's going to have a huge impact on the quality of movement that people have while they're training.
Hmm. Well, can you name those four real quick? That's something we didn't do.
Yeah, sure. So the rib and really the rib position, but the rib and pelvic alignment is a big one. Neutral spine is another big one, and like Charlie Weingroff has talked so much about, that extends all the way up through the cervical spine. Dynamic valgus control or being able to control that knee collapsing in during everything, like one of the examples that I tell our staff and our interns is I don't want that lack of control and inward collapse of the knee in any exercise, like clearly not when they're jumping or when they're squatting or lunging or any of the more traditional thoughts, but not while they're setting up to do a pulley row or a one-arm dumbbell row or a dumbbell chest press or any of those things. We want to try to look for proper hip-knee-foot alignment with everything. And then the other one is scapular setting and movement. So if somebody's, let's say, back squatting, are their shoulder blades pulled back and down into a position where they're at least not tipped forward and like I kind of referenced with the hip and the hip flexor stretch earlier, where they're in a position where you can almost visualize them forcing the humeral head through that anterior shoulder capsule. And then, you know, we're looking for proper protraction and retraction during rowing movements. We're looking for proper setting during all upper body pressing movements and during lower body exercises, whether it's squats, lunges, deadlifts, whether it's barbell loaded, whether it's dumbbell loaded, all of those things. We're still kind of looking at those same basic concepts of, are we, do we have a neutral spine? Is our core and our, is our core positioned properly because of proper hip and rib alignment? Are we able to control knee position and hip knee foot alignment? And are we positioning our shoulder blades properly on top of our rib cage?
Mm-hmm. Well, and one thing I really didn't talk about earlier, and you guys will see this on the DVD, but just to let everyone know, I mean, you had some great pictures that you put up of how your athletes stand, and so they could see, you know, the people attending could see these asymmetries or these, you know, kind of non-neutral positions. And then again, when it came time to talk about, you know, these movement considerations, you guys had a lot of great examples in there and showed some of these things, how you would cue them and how you would correct them. So that was really cool to see. So just so everybody knows, they're going to get a lot more of this on the DVD as well. And then one other thing I wanted to have you hit on a little bit, just because I thought this was really cool, because I'm still, you know, kind of learning this PRI stuff and some of the taping. But you talked about the rock tape courses you had taken, and then you gave a couple examples in the DVD of how you used the tape to kind of influence your athletes and kind of get them in that more neutral position. Could you talk about that a little bit, maybe even give a quick example as well?
Sure. So we hosted the Rock Cape course at our facility, I think it was in February of this past year, and Perry Nicholson taught it, and I thought he did a great job. And one of the concepts that he was emphasizing was to think of taping in terms of pattern, and that in general isn't that new of a thought process to me. That's the think in terms of movements, not muscles idea just applied to taping. You know, having dug pretty deep down the PRI rabbit hole in advance of this, my first thought was, okay, let's try to apply these taping concepts to some of the PRI patterns. And what we started to play around with was, if we start to tape the muscles that PRI wants to facilitate in order to reestablish and maintain joint neutrality, that in fact accomplish what we're hoping. And we have members of the big guys, a former college football player, and he was having like what he would probably describe as right quad tightness. That's consistent with some of the patterns that PRI describes, as far as if your right hip is in a posteriorly tilted position, if your right pelvis is posteriorly tilted, that you can imagine how that might pre-stretch a rectus femoris. And when you go to extend, or when you go to flex the knee in a like rear foot elevated split squat position or a reverse lunge position, how attempting to stretch an already stretched muscle might give that sensation of stiffness or tightness. And we had been through some assessment stuff with him anyway, and were able to confirm that, you know, he was in one of these patterns. And we taped his, so all of his symptoms, so to speak, were on his right side. And we taped only his left leg. And what we tried to do is reinforce left leg hip extension, hip adduction, and hip internal rotation. And by pulling him into that position, his sensations of tightness and stiffness disappeared immediately. And when he trained throughout the next week, he had no problems at all. And that stuck for a pretty significant amount of time, given that we basically spent 3 minutes throwing some tape on him just to see, like, all right, let's see if this actually changes anything. Another application of that, and I don't, if you've been through like PRI Meyer King course, you know, left hamstring to help pull that pelvis back underneath into a more, pull it out of a flex position or anteriorly tilted position, and then using a left adductor to restore hip adduction, and using the adductors and then anterior glute medius to help restore and improve hip internal rotation on that side. And the postural respiration kind of correlate to that is a right triceps is used to pull the right shoulder blade into more of a posterior pelvic tilt. And then getting that right lower trap going can help reposition that scapula in the frontal plane as well, so or transverse plane. So we basically took the exact same concept and we just said, all right, let's tape a right tricep and let's tape a right low trap. And I think looking at it, it's so basic. But when we retested the PRI upper body test, this one of our other staff members went from not clear to clear right away with taping. And this, I've told other people about this, and they've tried it out on their clients. The case is that in most cases, you can use taping to reposition things back to a more neutral position. You know, certainly taping is a replacement for integrating neurological and muscular effort to re-strengthen and reposition and reinforce these positions. But I think in some of our situations where you may not have as much hands-on time to work with somebody as you would like, if you can tape them out of the gate to reinforce a neutral position and let them spend a few days there, I think that we may get some of the changes that we're looking for just by having them spend time living in that position. And then obviously, when you have tape on you, you're aware of when you start to move outside of that position because you can feel the tape stretching. You know, all of that said, the big point I wanted to make in the DVD is that it doesn't matter what your specialty is. If you're a person that loves to do instrument-assisted soft tissue work, if you're a person that tapes everything, if you're purely an exercise person, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you're able to pick up on these patterns and that you have some sort of method or skill set to affect the change that you want. And to me, it comes back, and this, I think, is a more of a physical therapy concept, but it's the idea of test, intervene, and then retest. And whether you like rock tape or tape, again, whether you like manual work or instrument-assisted work or whether you're exercise only, make sure that what you're attempting to do is actually working. At least that's what my thought process is, and that's what we continue to go back and always ask ourselves is, are we getting what we think we're getting with this? And let's make sure that we're actually testing and reassessing to make sure that we are.
Yeah, and that's a great point and a great way to finish up. And you know what I'll do, Kevin? I'll link back to where people can find out more information on your site about the DVD. And again, I really enjoyed watching it. There's some really cool ideas on there and things that got me thinking, especially, you know, the taping was pretty cool. I hadn't thought about using some of those PRI patterns yet because I'm just starting to learn about those things. So definitely something I'm going to be looking more into. So I'll get some info up about that. And, you know, as always, thanks for coming on here and sharing your work.
No, thank you, Joe. I appreciate you having me on and look forward to hearing your feedback and those from the other listeners here about what they think about the DVDs.
Yeah, definitely. Yep, we'll have you on here again as well. So thanks a lot.
Well, thanks, Joe.